Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette.
From Ferment About It. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, 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 this is Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. We're in New York City doing a special pre-record that'll air around Christmas 2014. But we got the guy here, Charlie Papazian, the godfather of craft beer in America. And thanks to John from Bitter and Esters, he's on the show tonight. So, John, tell us a little bit about why Charlie's in town and some of the things that you've been doing with him
sure.
at your store.
So, hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on. Charlie's in town because he has two new revisions of his book. He has The Complete Joy of Homebrew, which is a fourth edition, and he has Homebrew as a Companion, which is a second edition. So he has those coming out, and our friend Aisha at the New York Public Library actually got in touch with us saying, hey, John, Charlie wants to do a signing. Would you like to have him? And I thought for about a nanosecond and said, of course, this would be awesome. So Charlie's... Well, since this is in the future, Charlie was at the store and did a signing, and it went really swimmingly well. Thousands of people showed up. It was really great.
All right.
So we had a lot of fun.
So, Charlie, so I would like to talk to you about how you got started, because there's guys in the room, including Nazaree from Lower East Craft, who was born after you started all these things and didn't even know about you. And that's going to be one of our themes of the show is, you know, all the young guns in craft beer. Who is Charlie Papazian? So tell us about the revised book that's out. And because that's a good Christmas gift for people, and then we can go backtrack and talk about, you know, the early days and what's going on now with all these homebrewers too.
Well, the first thing I should say, and maybe the last thing later on, is relax, don't worry, have a homebrew, right?
Yeah,
right?
I said it.
Ring a bell. Yeah, you asked me how I got started or about the book.
Let's get a little background, and then you can tell us about the new edition.
Yeah, well, I started homebrewing in the 70s, and when I was a college student. After my University of Virginia days, I moved out to Boulder, Colorado, and people discovered that I knew how to make beer. You know, it was pretty simple beer, but it was, at the time, it was way better than what we thought we could buy. So we were making ales and stouts and porters, and those were considered pretty extreme beers in those days. Well, I was teaching classes, and I needed a syllabus. I needed some publication. I needed something. So I put together a mimeograph sheet, a six-page mimeograph sheet that later became a self-published book called The Joy of Homebrewing, a 76-page self-printed edition. And then the big edition came – the first big edition came out in 1984, and that's when I put all my – brewery visits and my homebrewing, my at that time 14 years of brewing experiences and talking to brewers and having figured out how beer was made on a large scale, whether it was a microbrewery or a very large brewery or a brew pub in England or even visiting the Guinness Brewery. I remember going to the Guinness Brewery and I was floored because the Guinness across the street in the pub was only 10 days from when it began fermenting. And all the homebrew books at the time, to give you an idea, had so much bad information in it that you would boil your black malt and grains
them.
Yeah, boil them. Yum, yeah. But the caveat was, well, you made stout and you had to age it for 4, 5, 6 months before
really?
It got smooth. And it did get smooth after a while.
Smoother.
But it had no, you know, there was no connect to reality of how good beer was being made. And so I put those dots together, connected all the dots. And then I did get a degree in nuclear engineering. And during my university days, I was drinking homebrew and I became dyslexic and nuclear became unclear, and I started a career in beer along the way. And I was a teacher of children and a teacher of adults in the 70s. And my book came together to put all of this experience and information in a format that expressed the camaraderie and the enjoyment of beer and the fun of beer and the fundamental science and established creative directions that people could go, putting fruit in your beer and honey in your beer. And in those days, putting honey in your beer and fruit in beer was as extreme as the most extreme imperial double hop, triple hop, Belgian upside down, sour fermented beer these days. I mean,
well, everything was fizzy awesome. Yellow liquid back then, right?
Exactly. That's what it was. Exactly.
We've also got, this is Andrew St. Thomas, one of the homebrew clubs, the Knights of Brooklyn.
Yes.
And Alex Weiner from a great homebrew shop, Brooklyn Homebrew Shop. So welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you very much. In 84, when you published the book, like, what was the reception? Was your publisher like, this is never going to fly? Or people were like,
Yeah. Well, the contract was signed. I got an advance. I started in writing this. And it wasn't until a year later that I heard that they had a change in management and they wanted to axe the book. And there were a few champions there in those days, Avon, that wanted to continue through. So they almost were going to just bail, pay me my advance, and never publish the book. That's what I had heard.
Wow.
So it did finally get published. They were so skeptical. They thought this was the craziest book that they ever invested in. I mean, jeez.
It would have been like not signing the Beatles. Like, you know, the craft brew movement would just be not here if that book wasn't published.
So the book came out. And it was $7.95, I think 300 and some odd page book, four or five times the size of any other existing homebrew book at the time. And all the other homebrewing books were selling for $1 to $2.50, maybe $2.95 at the most. And there was a mindset among homebrew supply store owners that their homebrewers are never going to buy a homebrew book for $7.95. So they pretty much refused to carry it. And homebrewers found my book and found out about homebrewing going through their bookstore. This is before Amazon. So yeah, way before Amazon wasn't even in our lingo. And, 20,000-30,000 copies were sold in the first half year or so. You know, and all of a sudden these people were showing up at homebrew shops with recipes from my book and they finally got it.
You know? And they weren't boiling their grains anymore.
It wasn't about being cheap. It was about people wanting to make good beer.
Well, they wanted the knowledge, I would imagine, right?
And the knowledge and a way to understand the process that, when I wrote these two, both of my books, The Homebrewer's Companion, which is an advanced, edition of The Joy of Homebrewing, essentially, I wrote those books to kind of capture the fun and enjoyment, but also the fundamental science that is understandable so that people, when they get through my book, they might not know the details about the latest gadgets and the sophisticated brewing systems out there, but that's not the purpose of my book. My purpose is to establish your knowledge and your background, get you excited about relaxing and not worrying and making homebrew and having fun, getting a few good beers under your belt, literally and figuratively, and trying new things.
That's great, man. And Alex, what did you bring from Broken Homebrew, the first homebrew we're drinking?
So I made a party gile beer. So that's one mash, getting two beers. This is the smaller gile, so this is the small beer. It's a session IPA that's made with American Autonom hops and German Mandarina Bavaria. Both this session beer and then the IPA gile, I was basically trying to make beer orange juice.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Well, Charlie, you must have people giving you homebrews all the time.
All the time.
So how does somebody, I mean, we're on the show now, so we've kind of got you here for 45 minutes, but, what is it like for you? People come up to you and saying, Charlie, this is my homebrew. I want you to try it.
How many hearts do you break?
I don't break any hearts. Sometimes I'm scared. What's in the glass? Usually people are so excited about meeting me and want to share the homebrew, and they want to share something special. So most of the time, this is really refreshing that it's a session beer.
Oh, yeah.
I'm into that. But usually it's the you know, these really super puckered, sour, two-year-aged, barrel-aged beers that are, or a Belgian ale that's 9%, a super duper. And these are the special beers that we all make. And these are the beer happens to be the beers that usually I encounter from people.
It's like going to a potluck, right?
Yeah.
You're not quite sure. Yeah.
Well, but they're all it. Usually, most of our, these days, they're all well made. I had a great beer at 508 Brew Pub last night down in Soho area. And it was a triple with coriander and honey. And boy, was it. It was 8.5%, but it's tasted. I couldn't taste the alcohol. It was like tasted as smooth as the session beer, and it was super.
That's dangerous.
John, are you working on a recipe with Charlie?
Yeah,
for your shop, Bitter and Esters.
We asked Charlie if he would write a recipe for us, and he wrote us a hoppy brown ale, which is using Mosaic and Nelson Sauvin hops. I noticed in it.
He just gave it
to me. It's very exciting. And what inspired you to do that?
Well, I was saying you wanted a special recipe, and I said, well, if I was going to brew a brown ale, what would I bring? What would I make next week?
What would Charlie drink?
And I would probably I wanted to go in a direction that I hadn't been before. A brown ale, dry hopped, late hopped, with hops that wouldn't typically be considered to be put into a brown ale. So Nelson Sauvin is from New Zealand, and it gives you a very passion fruit, fruity flavor, or a white wine flavor, and also the Mosaic is a very fruity character as well. So you don't think about that, about using those hops in quote-unquote American brown ale. And the one time I've done it a few times, but I brewed a really traditional Irish stout with Australian Galaxy hops.
Wow.
And dry hopped with and Galaxy hops give an extraordinary mango aroma and flavor to a beer. And when you put that in with dark malts, chocolatey malts, you get something different than if you had used those hops in a pale ale or an IPA. You get something that the chocolate and the mango combine, and you get another child. It's a child from another marriage, you know.
That's the beauty of homebrewing, isn't it? It's there's no beer that's just one way.
And I have a friend who says who never likes to drink dark beers, and when I had that on tap among my other beers, that was his favorite beer. The first time in his life he enjoyed dark beers.
So you homebrew. You're homebrewing.
I still homebrew.
That's awesome.
5 gallons at a time and simple system. I don't have a three-tiered $2,000 machine or pumps. I don't use pumps. I love gravity. Keep it simple, easy to clean.
That's great. Do you guys have a name for this beer, by the way? For the brown ale that Charlie brewed?
Did you name it?
No.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I put it in my backpack.
I mean, you go with Charlie Brown. I mean, it's just too obvious.
Yeah. All right, Andrew, thanks.
That's what it is.
The format, so at Bitter and Esters, I know you have classes and you're a homebrew shop. But tonight, are you going to brew the beer with Charlie?
No, we're not. Tonight is our bottle swap, so people are going to be bringing beer. And we actually told them, Charlie's not trying every beer. We don't want to kill Charlie on his visit. So we're going to pick the four best for you to try.
So this is the potluck we were talking
about. This is the potluck, yeah. So we're going to make sure you get the four best, and then you can pick the best one out of that, and they're going to get one of your books. So that should be
awesome. Let's tell us about the book. So the holidays are coming. What book did you reissue? Because I've got the first issue of Homebrewer's Companion.
The Complete Joy of Homebrewing just came out, fourth edition has just come out. The second edition you have in your hand there, the first edition of The Companion, which was written in 1993, 94, and that was in bad need of revisions. I've learned a lot about brewing in 20 years, I can assure you. So between the two books, I had both of the books I was revising at the same time. And I shuffled information from one to another and updated all the technical information about hops and grains and added some more information about process, and particularly in the Homebrewer's Companion, there's a significant more information about the new age of hops we are in these days, and how brewers are using them, and how they are grown, and how they're processed, and how to get those flavors and aromas in beers. Things that brewers are doing now with hops that weren't even imagined 25 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. It's just, it's a whole process. It's not only the brewers using the stuff, but the farmers having to grow it and providing it and processing it in a way where you maintain those characters.
That's amazing. And just so you know, it's the holiday show. So go to goodbrewseal.com. We have a whole bunch of every book that we've reviewed is on there. And they're great holiday gifts. We have Amazon links. So definitely check out Charlie Papazian's reissued book on the Good Brew Seal site. There's some other great books. Tom Acatelli's Audacity Hops, Steve Hindy's Craft Beer Revolution that we've reviewed. So again, for the holidays, check it out, goodbrewseal.com. We're going to be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
So you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, greatbrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. Greatbrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, greatbrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile Beer Cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit greatbrewers.com today.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're out here at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we're giving big thanks to heritageradionetwork.org this holidays. You can give gift memberships and check it out and donate and go to goodbrewseal.com and check out all the great beer books that we've interviewed here on Beer Sessions Radio. So we're doing a special holiday show. Charlie Papazian's flown in. He's got his new books, his old books being reissued two or three times, but I've got the Homebrewers Companion from 1994 in front of me. There's some great things in this book. There's this guy, Professor Michael Lewis, who wrote your original foreword. He kind of sums up everything that you did. He said he's just talking about the importance of education and homebrewing and all the work you did. Can you say something about him? Because I love looking at the forewords of books and seeing how that what this guy had to say about you.
Yeah, Professor Michael Lewis, University of California, Davis. He is a pioneer. He was teaching the big brewers how to brew, and also scaled that had classes and degree courses for new brewers and small brewers and home brewers. He was very supportive of the home brewing movement and really welcomed quality information. And he's retired, but he's still very active. And the current professor, Charlie Bamforth at UC Davis, he wrote the foreword for my fourth edition. Of the complete joy of homebrewing. So I got both professors, legendary guys that are just express their
well. That's going to be in my Christmas stocking. I hope my wife's listening. But so Charlie, you're talking about the change in the 20 years since the first books you wrote, the difference in hops and ingredients and, mm-hmm. and just general expectations, right?
Well, the expectation these days is that if you're going to make beer, you not just want to make cheap beer. You want to make beer that's as good as you can buy. And back in the early days, there was a notion that home brewing was trying to make cheap beer. And a lot of those early homebrew books, particularly from England, were designed, and from Canada, were written with that in mind. And that's not – when I started teaching homebrew classes, we all knew that we were into the flavor, into the character – you know, homebrewers are, I wouldn't call them, they're often characterized as being cheap, but I think they're just smart. They want to get as much extract out of their
frugal, I think is the word.
Frugal and buy smart, you know?
Charlie, when you first started teaching classes, it was illegal, right? Homebrewing in America
was illegal? Yeah, of course. Yeah, 1978.
Did I just out you? I'm sorry.
No, 1979, 78, and actually...
Statute of limitations.
Yeah, I was teaching beer-making classes in Boulder during the days when it was illegal. I was featured in feature stories in newspapers. I was on television a lot, and it was illegal.
Awesome.
Eventually, one of my beer classes, I was warned by the administration of the community free school that they said, you know, we think that an ATF agent is going to take your class. And sure enough, this guy anonymously took my class. But he wasn't too anonymous because this is 1970s Boulder, Colorado, right? He showed up. He was the only one in the class wearing slacks, a white shirt, and a black necktie.
With a badge.
Maybe. And he got into, he took two classes, and he was stirred the pot and tasted all the beer, and he was one of the gang, and then he left. And I, you know, when he was there the first night, I made an effort to say, you know, it's not really actually it's not legal, but the ATF has better things to do than bust homebrewing, homebrewers, and just make it for your personal use. Don't sell it. I mean, and I got away with that. And he left us alone. I mean, I think if he did bust me, it would have popularized homebrewing a lot more.
Right.
A lot more quickly.
Front page news.
Let's get everybody. So, Alex, do you have a question for Charlie?
My main question, I guess, is I think a lot of homebrewers these days are revitalizing very old either styles or ways of brewing, like decoction and party gile, and you know, the BJCP is adding some very old styles in their new their new listings.
Yeah,
and I'm just curious, coming off the whole new hops and new things, like how much of progress do you see being doing completely new things, or people just rediscovering what was done a long time ago and has gone by the wayside with technology?
Yeah, after you've been brewing as long as I have, it gets to a point where, you know, there's actually, sometimes it seems there's nothing new. You know, you always discover some historical context of what you think you just created for the first time. And on an earlier show here at Heritage Radio Network, I was talking about how I brew. I still brew 5 gallons at a time. And I instill this kind of spirit in my book, both of my books as well, is that you get the fundamentals of brewing, how to brew, how to use the equipment, what it's all about. And then you should be inspired to try new things, you know, brew with local ingredients, fruits, spices, things that you've never heard of people using in beer. But also, one of the things that I do, as well as experimenting, is I go back historically to beers that I remember 20, 30 years ago, really great beers, like Guinness Stout. The Guinness Stout today is not the Guinness Stout of 20 years ago. It was all bottle conditioned, and it was delicious. And they used real roasted barley, and they used real hops, and they didn't use they used hop extract now. And I go back and recreate that flavor. And you know, the original Pilsners, the original German-style Helles's that you go, and if you travel Germany, they don't have as much character as they used to. But I remember tasting that character in the 80s, and my recipes in my book are specifically designed to recreate that older tradition that has been lost, but I think are being rediscovered by homebrewers and craft brewers all over the world. Like, you know, people want to go back to some of the more characterful beers and the original way these styles were made.
Great. Andrew, do you have a question for Troy?
Sure, yeah. This is maybe a bit off topic. What do you drink when you don't drink beer? What's your go-to? Do you get tired of beer? Do you switch to something else, or is it just homebrew all the time?
Whoa, well, I drink fizzy water.
Okay.
I don't like soft drinks.
So you drink Coors Light? Fizzy water. No. I'm kidding.
I know after when I get really thirsty on a hot day, sometimes I do drink that stuff. But it's not because I'm tasting it. It just feels good and cold and refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
So with all this home brewing that you know, you're just hearing your name makes me thirsty. Why have you never opened a brewery? You must have been approached to actually do
good
this
question,
commercially.
John.
Yeah, it's very good. I get that question asked a lot. You know, have you ever thought about opening up your own brewery, Charlie? And I say, of course I have, you know. But then I think about it, and I see I've visited thousands of breweries all over the world. I love these people who make it. It's a different kind of business. I really enjoy my world and the way I love education. I love writing. I like my homebrew, and do I really want to get into another business of not only making a beer consistently and then trying to sell it and market it and regulate and abiding by more regulations than I care to discuss. it's a challenge, and it's a different approach to the world of beer. And
you might get bored.
I love what I do. So why do I want to change that?
Good one. Nasri's got a great new blog, Lower East Craft. He's been carving some beer events. And he was born in 1992. He's the guy that said, I don't know who Charlie Papazian is. I was born after he did anything.
That's when I started homebrewing. It was 1992, just so you know.
So, Nasri, what's your question for Charlie?
Well, my question is really to sort of the age issue is, you know, I'm ostensibly a child. A child can buy beer. But, you know, growing up, like even in college, we had a lot of stuff available. Oh, I don't really know how microphones work either. We had a lot of stuff available that, you know, you guys didn't. You know, double IPAs and really strong stouts and oatmeal stouts and all these new styles that used to be kind of rare. And so I guess my question for you would be, for people getting into it now, people my age, entering this scene and seeing this limitless potential, how would you orient yourself? How would you sort of think about these things when you can go down to your corner bodega and buy, you know, the triple Belgian IPA? And, you know, is that a good introduction to it, or how would you orient yourself in the craft beer scene now, I guess?
Great. Thanks, Nasri.
Oh, well, there's two questions there I think you just asked. How do you orient yourself as a home brewer getting involved in home brewing for the first time? And maybe how do you get involved with craft beer scene as far as what you want to try for the first time if you never had craft beer? Right.
I think my question is really the whole the fact that there's so many less boundaries. Like before, it was kind of fun to make a porter because no one was selling porters, and now you go down to the store and you buy a porter, and it's like, oh, okay, because you mentioned earlier you should only make a good beer as good as what you can buy, and when you can buy so many good beers, how do you start? Where do you start? You know. How do you push the boundaries almost when there are so few left? When there's so much open space?
There's so many different kinds of people that get involved in home brewing. They come from all walks of life, and their personalities really play into, individualizing one's approach. You know, what I would suggest is not, you know, your first few batches. I mean, if you read my Complete Joy of Home Brewing, if you read the first 36 pages, that's all you'd have to read, and you could make your first batch of beer. I would suggest I wouldn't call them lighter styles of beer, but let's just say less extreme styles. And if you really have the personality where you really want to be unique and really express yourself right off the bat, throw in some unusual. Go to your homebrew supply store. Talk to them. I want to make a pale ale. I want to make a brown ale. But I want something different. And the recipe that I designed for Bitters and Esters is just that. It's a simple, straightforward recipe, basically, the flavors. But there's an accent of fruit and aromas that aren't typical in a brown ale, using unusual hops. So you can stamp your personality on even some of the – you can individualize even some of the more simpler beers. Get those under your belt first.
That's a great way. How did you start, John? What were some of the first homebrews you made in 1992?
I was out in California visiting a friend, and we were at a beer festival. There was five beers. I was like, oh, my God, that's a lot. And he said, you know, we can make this. I'm like, yeah, sure. So we went and we got Charlie's book. I got the Complete Joy of Homebrewing second edition. And there it was. But there was nowhere to buy stuff. There were wine stores. There was one guy who sold stuff out of a garage. And there was no internet. So it was just you and me, Charlie, and I think I made every recipe in that book because that was it, and they were great. They came out really fantastic, and it was at that point it was hey, this tastes like beer. Like you're actually doing this.
Yeah, you're not making a homebrew back there like Prohibition. You're actually making something that you'd want to buy.
Right.
So homebrew is not a pejorative term. It's really a good term.
Yeah, it used to be back when I first started. It was a pejorative term, but things have changed.
Well, it was like, what is this moonshine? Yeah, it's like, no, it's my own beer.
So, Nasri, you know, for you, homebrew is probably the best beer in the world. I mean, you know, you that's what it is now.
Well, actually, my first homebrew was a Bitter Nestor's at John's store for my 21st birthday. So I think in a way the cycle continues where you inspired John and John inspired me, and I hope to be back soon. So it keeps going. I guess, you know, you just want to include more people. I think you made a great point about people's characters really makes it stand out. The craft beer community works really well because so many people are so passionate about it and are true to themselves and bring their passion to it.
Yeah, it's, you know, whether you're a chef or a brewer or a food, you know, you're a farmer. I mean, the quality of what you do is getting your personality and your passion involved.
That's great. So, Andrew, what's this beer you made?
Right
second
now,
beer.
Yeah, right now we're, funny enough, Alex talked about wanting to make a really orange juice beer. This is kind of my lemonade beer. This is a lightly sour Berliner Weiss, dry hopped with Amarillo hops. Triple decoction on this guy, kettle soured, and then dry hopped with Amarillo, as I said. So it's got like really high effervescence, lemony.
Yeah. Lemony.
Yeah. So that was the idea. It's like, it's a little out of season, but it's kind of like a good summer beer. 3.2%. It's, you know, sessionable.
Refreshing. And,
yeah, this is a nice social. This is a nice cross section of New York City, like, kind of homebrew guys. Because John, you're more like Charlie. You're more of an educator.
I'm more of an educator and a homebrewer. And...
But Andrew, you have some professional ambitions?
Yeah, I've been talking with various people to start a brewery in town here. Possibly in Brooklyn, possibly in Long Island City. And I also have some ambitions to start distilling as well. So, which distilling is a natural, you know, the next step of brewing. So just to keep myself interested. So.
Right. And then Alex, you work at Brooklyn Homebrew.
Yeah.
Right now, what are your ambitions? I mean, you're doing a great job in homebrew, working in a homebrew shop.
I teach a lot of the classes at Brooklyn Homebrew, and that's probably one of the highlights of my job is teaching the classes. I love introducing people to good beer, craft beer, homebrew. One day I would like to open my own brewery, but this stage of my life right now, I'm actually making kids more than I am making beer. So.
I know that feeling.
Well, that's a little cross section, Charlie. I don't know. What do you think of the New York City craft beer scene?
You know, when was the first time I came to New York City? I think there's a picture of me, one of those early newsletters, New York City Homebrewers Guild, mid-1980s, 89.
Oh, I saw that picture. Yeah.
Like, Garrett Oliver was still a homebrewer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I remember people were really passionate then. They're passionate now. And I get that question asked, you know, what's the transition from back in the 70s or things like, what was the first Great American Beer Festival like in 1982 when I started the Great American Beer Festival? And there were 700 people, and now there's more breweries than there were people at the beer festival, first beer festival. And it was on a smaller scale, but the passion and the excitement of what was happening was the same. I mean, it was when you have good beer and there's discovery as part of the process, and good things happen, and people get psyched, and you get, it's kind of like, people get attracted like a magnet. They want to be involved, maybe as a beer drinker, and start discovering this whole world they didn't know about, or become a home brewer.
Yeah.
And
do you think that beer's part of a healthy lifestyle? Because I drink beer every day. You look good, man. I have a beer every day.
I intend to have beer till I depart.
And, you can't anymore.
You know, maybe there'll be their beer up there wherever I end up. You know, I know some old timers that they still drink beer, a glass a day. And then some people who, you know, if you overdo it, you're kind of cutting your end game off as far as being able to enjoy beer. So moderation is a real key to enjoying it for a long time.
My father always said that too. My father had to drink every day too. So I think that's an important part. I like to have this public conversation because, you know, there's been so many issues about drinking and health, and I'm finally seeing, like, even in New York State, people that work for the governor are coming out and saying, you know, beer, cider, wine, spirits, craft, you know, craft beverages made in state or made locally are an important part of not only the economy but people's lifestyle. And we did recently look at some of the post-prohibition laws in New York State, and it was crazy. I mean, basically, there was this understanding that everyone in the business was in the mob or had been breaking rules in prohibition. Mm-hmm. So now their job was, you're legal, but you have to be controlled. And I think now, how many generations later, people are actually realizing, and only just now I think the laws are changing. Like, now, what, 50 states allow home brewing?
Yes.
So it's only just, what is this, how many years since prohibition are we finally coming to terms with changing language to accept that this is a natural part of our life, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, you talked about the governor of New York and all the great things, that attitude that government has here in New York State. And it's, you know, the politics of beer is jobs, the jobs that are created in the beer world of craft beer. It's also, another significant shift that's happened is that people's attitude about beer is that I think more people recognize that beer, it can be enjoyed responsibly. Well, back in the 70s and 80s, you couldn't get a reporter or talk beer on a radio show or even show beer on a television show. People would just stay clear because it had such a negative, bad image. And
it's come
that
a long
is
way.
A long way. And I think craft beer and craft and home brewers have been fundamentally the reason why that shift.
Thank you, Charlie.
Well, this is great. We got Charlie Papazian, the godfather of craft beer in America, on our show. It's our holiday special. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's our special holiday edition, December 2014. We got the Godfather of Craft Beer, Charlie Papazian. His new book's out. Check it out. It's one of the new editions with Homebrewer's Companion, The Complete Joy of Homebrewing. Check it out on Amazon. Go to Good Brew Seal. He's got some great new editions out. And Charlie, so happy to have you on. So we're talking a little bit about regulation and how things have evolved. You know, New York State recently, even the State Liquor Authority changed its charter, the language on the charter, to basically recognize that, you know, craft beer and spirits and cider and wine is an important part of the economy and of our lifestyle and culture.
Exactly. And
things have changed a lot in 20 years, right?
Yep. And, you know, we're talking about the politics of beer, and politics is such that, you know, job growth is an important issue, and craft brewers and, you know, the fundamentally home brewers from home brewing, craft brewers emerged and have created hundreds of thousands of jobs. And also the attitude towards alcohol has changed dramatically since the 70s. When I started the American Home Brewers Association in 1978, we were at zero members, and we were at 43,000 members now. But back in those days, you talked to reporters, radio stations, television programs, didn't want to have anything to do with beer. I mean, beer? What do you want to talk about beer? Six pack, and you watch the game. That's about it. That's about as the only connection, any news story. That's the only news story that they could think of. So it was really a long haul to get people to believe that you could actually enjoy beer responsibly, and there was flavor and diversity and culture and camaraderie. And
now the American Homebrewers Association actually helps with legislation. I mean, they were pretty much responsible for getting homebrewing legal in all 50 states, right? Yep. And you started that.
Yeah, I started that in 1978, and that's when homebrewing was illegal. Wasn't legalized till 1979. I started it coincidentally when it became legal. I was going to start it come hell or high water. but the laws changed one by one because the way laws work, alcohol laws work in this country, is the federal law is one thing, but every state has the right to regulate alcohol the way they want it. And one by one, the states legalized home brewing. It wasn't until last year, 2013, that Alabama and Mississippi were the last two states to legalize home brewing. You know, can you believe that?
I met a homebrew shop owner from Alabama at NHC in Philly, and I said, "Wow, you know, congratulations! How long have you been in business?" He was like, 25 years. I said, "You've been illegally doing this all this time?" He's like, "Yeah, I don't care." It's hilarious. I was like, "Just like you." You're like, "Yeah, it's illegal, but we did it."
But it's like, so it's actually a generational shift, isn't it? It's kind of like the new generation, like Nazari's, you know, early 20s. For him, came of age drinking great craft beer.
Yeah. And, you know, there was an issue with interest in home brewing slowing down in the late 90s. And for those of you who can recall, the late 90s was boom time. It was everybody could get a job and microbrews were starting to, were established and you could buy beer. You could, you know, so a lot of the home brewers were working more, didn't have time to brew, but they had the money, so they would buy. And also, there was an attitude, a generational attitude that, you know, didn't really reach out to the younger generation, the next generation of home brewers. And so home brewing slowed down in the early part of this century, but we realized that, and everybody realized that, it's more fun when you get a diversity, not only with the beer that you drink, but the diversity of people. And young homebrewers were just as welcome as old timers. And everybody had a story. Everybody had great beer. And it didn't matter whether you were blue or red or gray or white or independent or what. People got along together with good beer. And that's what kept, that's what has brought home brewing, and the American Home Brewers Association is as strong as ever. Our conference next year will be in San Diego. We expect close to 5,000, 6,000 people.
So cool.
So the offshoot of what you've done, you know, with like the Craft Brewers Association and GAP, so the more commercial side is like things like Craft Brewers Conference, which I went to last year and I thought was great. But how would you compare the America Homebrewers Conference to something like the Craft Brewers Conference?
Well, the Craft Brewers Conference has 5 or 6 or 7 different tracks. Business, finance, marketing, technical brewing, beer and food, you name it. There's, you know, it's the business of craft beer, government affairs, homebrewing. It's all about fun. There's a lot of professional craft brewers that every once in a while go back to their roots and love to come to the Home Brewers Conference because it's about fun. It's about beer, beer, beer. And it's about your home brew and what people are doing and the new products that are out there, new ideas. And I tell you, club night there is one of the funnest things in the world where there's usually 50 to 70 homebrew clubs, and they're on display, and they have barrels of their beers, and they're pouring, and it's a great time.
It's community.
Right.
When's the next one, Charlie, the next American Homebrewers Conference?
It's in San Diego first, I think it's about the second weekend of June. Second week of June.
Next year. Yeah. And have you guys, but John, have you been to that, Andrew?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've been to
when it was in Philly. Yeah. Did you go to the one in...
I was in Philly, yeah.
Or did you go to...
I did not go to Michigan this year.
Michigan? You didn't? Did you go to Michigan?
What did you note about the conference?
Well, I've been to both the Craft Brewers Conference and the Home Brewers Conference. And, yeah, as Charlie said, I mean, the CBC is very professional, and I mean, there's still beer that's being had, but it doesn't have that same camaraderie. I mean, talk about club night. I mean, there's 50 homebrew clubs, each pouring 12 beers. One is different from the next. You're getting...
Are they from all over the country?
All over the country. And I think probably some international ones. We get people in from Canada. And it's nuts. I mean, like, you just... It's death by a thousand sips, as my friend says, you know, because you just can't try it all, and everything is more exciting than the next. One of the cool things about homebrewing, you're right, is that, like, you can experiment all the time.
Yeah.
You don't have to dedicate yourself to making the same pale ale every day. It could be a great pale ale, but you can make a pale ale. I've made your pale ale with your rosemary pale ale, and that's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it's just like a crazy beer that, you know, a professional brewery probably wouldn't put out, but if you're making 5 gallons...
Homebrewers are on the cutting edge. There was one beer I remember at the Seattle conference a few years ago, and it was a great beer. It was a smoked beer made with apples, but instead of using smoke malt, they barbecued, they smoked the apples and put the apples
nice.
In the beer.
Yeah, that's
and
fantastic.
It was fantastic.
Right. And you could never scale that up on a professional level. You know, that's what makes it so cool. It's like, here's a one-off, you know, at the homebrewer conference here. This is from this barrel that we had. It's been sitting for 2 years. Eh, try it. You know, the experimentation is one of the best parts. So it's highlights of the show.
Yeah. It's going to be June of 2015.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. You know that every one in every 200 adult Americans is a home brewer. There's 1.25 million home brewers in this
country.
We're
trying to make more of them.
Yes. There's never enough.
Me and Alex. We're
the world
in New York
can
City.
Be a better
we're
place.
Trying to make more of them. We're making sure of that.
Pretty much a sold out class every month for beginners.
People who love it.
Every time, 10 to 12 people sold out every month.
I call it giving birth to homebrewers. Charlie, since this is a holiday show, you have done so much. You've done the American Homebrew Station, the Great American Beer Festival, Zymergy Magazine, all this stuff. But you also started National Pi Day, didn't you? P-I-E. Not the number, but
Yes, I did.
And what is up with that?
I did start it, and it was kind of a little quirky thing I did when I was teaching kindergarten and first, second graders. I said to them, well, today is National Pi Day. It was my birthday. And I said, tell all your moms that it's National Pie Day, it's Charlie, your teacher's birthday, and bring in a pie for Charlie. And it worked.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's how Special it started. And then I entered it into a publication in those days, which was the publication that media used for national days of interest. It was Chase's calendar of events. I submitted that as National Pie Day, and then things got rolling, and then people in Boulder established a National Pie Council, and then it got taken over by the pie industry.
Big pie.
And now, you know, we joked about the Crisco Bake Off, but that's what it is. It's the Crisco Pie National Pie Championship in Florida every January 23rd on my birthday.
It's still on your birthday. Yeah. That's great.
Do you make pie?
Yeah, when's your book of pie recipes coming out?
I do make pie.
Do you make pie with beer?
Of course I drink beer when I'm running out. Yeah.
Maybe like, you know, kidneys sautéed and
that triple I had last night at 508. I was thinking this beer would go great with a blueberry pie,
nice.
Peach pie. But yeah.
Well, cheers to Charlie, man.
Cheers to Charlie.
And a Merry Christmas, because it's almost Christmas time by the time you hear it.
Make some pie.
If the holiday is here, there's a holiday cheer recipe in my Complete Joy Home Brewing, which is one of the four most popular recipes. One is Rocky Raccoon's Honey Lager. Toad Spit Stout. The Holiday Cheer is a beer that's made with some nutmeg and cinnamon, and it's kind of an amber beer, and it's one of the more popular recipes that people make.
Charlie, what do you think about Christmas beers in general? Like, now there's so many great breweries making Christmas beers, but I feel like they're stronger, and there's a trend to drink the Christmas beers in July, which I think makes sense. So I feel like when you get those beers at Christmas time, they're so strong, and I feel like they need time to mellow.
Well, you know, brewing is an interesting approach, because an IPA, remember when hoppy beers, they were you aged them. But now brewers want you to drink hoppy beers fresh. When the brewery releases them, you need to drink them, because that's the way they designed it to taste. So you'd make holiday beers, strong holiday beers. If I were a brewer, I'd be making, if it was something that needed a little time in the tanks, I'd make it in August or July and keep it. But once it's in the bottle, and you as a professional brewer, once it's in the bottle, people drink it, you're not going to tell them to stash it, because they might stash it in their 80-degree closet, or they might stash it in their basement, or they might put it in the trunk of their car, or put it in the light on the shelf, and it's not going to be the same. So the brewer wants you to taste it right after they bottled. That's the freshest.
Well, that's a good point. Going back, back to your book, The Homebrewer's Companion, which is the one I'm reading, your early tastes of beer were Old Ballantines. And I know some brewers are trying to recreate what the Old Ballantine was. What was the Old Ballantine ale?
I just what my Uncle Paul used to drink, a Ballantine ale. But the Ballantine IPA is probably more legendary. And that beer, as I recall, it was just been reissued. And I talked to the brewers. It's 7.2% alcohol. I said, wow, Did you ramp up the alcohol? I said, well, that's the original recipe. Original recipe was, it was a 7.2% beer. But it didn't have the hop character that in 1982 at the Great American Beer Festival, they brought it, and it had loads of Cascade hops in it. Of course, Cascade hops was just being introduced in those days. And it was a really terrific beer. Had a lot of hop aroma and hop flavor character. The one that's out now is a good shot. It's probably more accurately what was brewed in the 1950s.
You know, Mitch Steele from Stone made a beer with Smutty Nose. It was called Cluster's Last Stand. And it was his homage to the Ballantine IPA. Mm-hmm. And it kind of tastes like a Stone 7.2% IPA. I don't know, did any of you try that?
Mm-hmm.
But so what did you think of that? That's kind of cool, right, that people, that professional brewers as well as home brewers can go back and look at mm-hmm. historical beer.
Yeah, I think it's really great seeing these new styles being regenerated from the homebrew community. I think that's where it sprouts from and then kind of, you know, spills over to the professionals. You know, Gozas are taking off right now, and styles of beer, like Lichtenhainers, and, you know, these all
Keller
these
beers.
Keller beers. Yeah, you know, beers that weren't really popular, but I think homebrewers were the ones that kind of popularized them.
I know, you know, the Ballantine Ale you're talking about is probably one of the first beers I ever had, but that's not the IPA, the Ballantine in the green bottle.
Yeah, exactly.
That was where I learned what skunk smelled like.
Yeah.
It was from that beer, because that beer was always skunked. Oh, I had one the other day, actually, that wasn't skunked. I was like, oh, let me try this. And it went down. It was all right. You know, I figured, let me try it again.
Well,
it was
$2. I remember the aroma because I grew up not too far from New York City. I grew up in New Jersey, and I come to the New York Yankee Stadium.
Cool.
I watched Mickey Mantle, Maris. That was my time.
Nice.
But I remember the smell of Ballantine Ale. It was all over the stands. It was, you know, drank and spilled, and it was all over the place. But that was Rheingold and Schaefer and right. Ballantine.
Schlitz.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the days.
Good times in beer, man. Who wants to wrap it up? So, John, what are you going to have going on for the new year at Bitter and Esther's?
At Bitter and Esther's, more of what we do, events and brew on premises. And we're going to have a lot more new classes coming out. Hopefully we'll have some more guests like Charlie coming in. We're just going to keep teaching people how to brew beer.
It's a great place, man. I give homage to Bitter and Esther's, and it was the place that made me realize I would never make beer.
I taught Jimmy not to make beer.
He made a great class, all the cleaning, and I was like, this is why I don't make beer.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
Yeah.
And Andrew, anything, the Knights of Brooklyn.
Yeah, Knights of Brooklyn.
What's going on 2015?
Yeah, we will have our first competition, our first homebrew competition in February. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Knights of Brooklyn. This year, in 2015, we will be having thematic competition, so there'll be a certain ingredient that you want to use in your homebrew, and then you'll judge on that rather than having a wide selection of beers.
That's great. And Alex at Brooklyn Homebrew Shop?
Hopefully a lot of people know, we moved into a much larger space over the summer, so now we have dedicated class space, so a lot more classes, a lot more space in all of those classes. They're doing very well. Great, make great Christmas presents.
Brooklyn Homebrew Shop.
Yeah,
it's great.
We should have a softball team. Like, we should play softball against the
We want team. Charlie to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
What position would you play?
A position I would play home plate.
All right.
You do the actual plate.
Well, I would suggest the holiday season, give the gift that keeps on giving. And whether you buy it for yourself or for a friend, you'll get many happy returns.
So your book. So tell us again, what the latest book,
The Complete
that's out,
Joy of Homebrewing, if you're
fourth edition.
Fourth edition, if you're a beginner, read the first 36 pages and you'll never regret it. You'll never look back. And if you really get into beer, go on to the Homebrewer's Companion and you will be as creative as the most creative and most skilled craft brewer
out
there.
This has been a great pleasure having you, Charlie. And also on the New York City event front, end of February is New York City Craft Brewer Week is back, New York City Beer Week is back, and our great event, New York City Brewer's Choice, this year, all the 30 brewers, some from New York and some from beyond, will be making beers all with local New York grains and malts.
And if I could get you all to say in unison,
relax. Don't worry. Have a homebrew.
All right, and Merry Christmas to everybody. So thanks so much for joining
us.
Thanks to our sponsors, greatbrewers.com, have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Charlie, John, Andrew, Alex, Nazari, and everyone else for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Maggie Seiden and Justin Kennedy, and our engineer, Jack Inslee. Thanks for listening. Merry Christmas, and we'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
All right.
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.